Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In recent years, a record 181 million Americans took advantage of this country's outdoor recreation opportunities, and the number is growing. It includes nearly 60% of all Americans over the age of six. And North Carolina has a wide variety of those opportunities, including state and national parks. The money generated from those activities has nearly doubled in just over a decade, bringing in $17.8 billion to the state's economy each year. Summer is the time when most people take advantage of outdoor recreation, so now is a good time to find out more about what's available, what's behind the growth of these leisure options, and how to stay safe when you do. Helping us take us through all of this is Dr. Ash Morgan. He's a professor of economics and director of the Center for Economic Research and Policy Analysis at Appalachian State University. He's here along with Dr. Keith Cradle, founder of Camping with Cradle. That's a Charlotte-based nonprofit and outdoor mentoring program geared toward underserved youth. And Greg Batts is with us. He's district biologist at the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
Ash, I'm going to begin with you. Nationally, according to the Outdoor Foundation of the Outdoor Industry Association, families with kids are at the highest rate on record of participation in outdoor recreation, while significant growth is also being seen among Black and Hispanic participants. Even seniors are up. I believe these numbers are right, 7.4% since 2019, but trends show the number of outings each year has declined, which are signals of a kind of more casual participation. Those are national figures. What are we seeing in North Carolina?
Yeah, so in North Carolina, I mean, I can speak more to the western side of the state, if that's sure. Okay.
Yes.
So I know you pulled out a number there, 17.5 billion, I think you said, for the, I'm guessing that's the whole state. And so the western part, actually, myself and a couple of colleagues, John Whitehead, who's also at App State, and Melissa Weddle, who's at the University of Montana, we did a study on Western North Carolina outdoor recreation, which is a participation survey with the Made by Mountains group in Asheville. And so we conducted a study actually looking at outdoor recreation, again, in the western part of the state. And basically surveying all the people who come into this part of the state, those from the other part of North Carolina, plus the adjacent states, you know, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee. And so essentially what we tried to do was kind of get at your question, you know, what is the sort of economic impact of outdoor recreation, specifically in the western part of North Carolina? And so we're looking at all these people who travel into this part of the state from those adjacent areas. And then when they come in, you know, they're bringing their money with them. And so, you know, they might be traveling to say Buncombe County or Watauga County, and they're going to do some mountain biking or outdoor hiking or fishing, but then they're perhaps staying for a couple of days while they're here or longer, staying in hotels or other form of accommodation, spending the money in restaurants and things like that. And so what we found was the economic impact, which is when you look at all that flow of money coming in and they're staying here and they're spending their money, and then that money travels on in the secondary spending levels, the economic impact, this is an annual level, is about, again, for this part of the state, for the 25 counties on the western portion, including the Qualla boundary, the economic impact from outdoor recreation was about $4.9 billion. And that creates about 48,000 full-time jobs, again, in the western part of the state, about $1.5 billion in labor income.
That same survey that you conducted, if I'm not mistaken, the Western North Carolina Outdoor Recreation Participation Survey, you found that the three most popular outdoor recreation activities were hiking, nature viewing, and scenic driving. two of those don't require any exertion whatsoever. Did that surprise you?
Not really. You know, and some of it is a function of just the other things you do. So you weren't constrained to just saying, you know, so often people come for, you know, they want to go hiking. But while they're hiking, they might decide to take a nice little trip on the, on a you know, a local highway, a nice, see a nice vista, or do something else. So they want, you're not constrained to just that, the main purpose, the main activity of your trip. So not really. While they're here, they might want to do something else. Not really. That's just picking that piece of information up.
And the survey also, the U.S. Department of Commerce, Bureau of Economic Analysis figures from this year shows that outdoor recreation is a powerful driver. These are their words, powerful driver of economic growth and community vibrancy. But several years ago, as we all know, Hurricane Helene tore through the western stretches of North Carolina, devastated places that are outposts for outdoor recreation and whose economy in large part depends on people coming there to take advantage of that. What progress, Ash, has that area of the state made in returning things to normal for the opportunities and the revenue that they provide? Are you close to being at normal, or do you still have a ways to go?
Yeah, I think it's close to being back. You know, Helene was about 20 months ago, 18 to 20 months ago. And obviously certain parts of, you know, even the western side past Asheville were really severely hit. The same group I mentioned, I did that study, is actually working on a new one, looking at the economic impact of Hurricane Helene. But that's sort of ongoing work right now. So we don't have we have some preliminary results, but we don't have the, you know, the precise findings. But basically, to answer your question, yeah, you know, there's been a rebound. People are starting to come back again. You know, it was huge, right? I mean, Helene was like over 100 people died. The Weather Channel said there was about $60 billion worth of infrastructure damages. I think the Made by Mountains group did a survey, and they found about 90% of businesses reported revenue losses following Helene. So, I mean, the impact was massive. Obviously, so you get that initial drop in recreation trips. So people decide, you know, people who were going to come here decide to go somewhere else. And that's what's nice about the original report that we did, really backed right up onto Helene. Of course, at the time, we didn't know it was going to happen. But so what we're going back to do now is look at, okay, so you said you would take this number of trips to Western North Carolina. Well, then a hurricane hit and, you know, we have all that infrastructure damage, you know, how many trips did you take? And so from that, we're going to be able to figure out exactly the impact of Helene. But there was a dip, yeah, and but now it's beginning to recover. And I think trips are sort of back to baseline, almost basically back to where they would have been, you know, had Helene not occurred in the first place.
I know if you want to go whitewater rafting or you want to go canoeing, you can rent canoes, you can have guided tours down various rivers, etc. How many of the recreational activities in Western North Carolina are run by private enterprise, and how many of them are simply open to the public because they are national or state parks?
Yeah, I don't know the precise breakdown, but obviously, yeah, of course you do have both. You have the sort of for-profit groups, who are, you know, looking at, you're talking about whitewater rafting guides or fishing guides, and then you have the state and national parks. I don't know the precise breakdown, but, you know, in these, when you're looking at the overall effect, you would include both of those things, whether or not it's a, you know, it's a private entity or a state or a public entity. You know, we're interested in understanding the sort of economic impact of both of those groups.
You conducted a study a couple of years ago, I guess we've been talking about it, the Western North Carolina Outdoor Recreation Participation Survey, which was aimed at creating a baseline for that sector of our economy. And you discovered that the average stay for tourists taking advantage of all this is around 2.5 nights for a party of three who take an average of 4 trips a year. What else did you discover?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we want to do, really, to provide a baseline. We realized that recreation to this part of the state was very important as an economic driver, as you mentioned, but we didn't really know how important. So that was really the overall task, was to just to provide a baseline for that level of importance. And again, that's where that economic impact study came from. You know, we also just try to break out some of the to sort of understand like who's coming, you know, where they're staying. And so you know, the different activities that you mentioned. So we wanted to break out, you know, when they're coming, well, what are they doing? So you mentioned, you know, hiking being the most popular, but nature viewing, scenic driving, fishing, swimming. We really want to break it out to see what activities people were participating in. And then just try to get a sense of just the types of stay and where they're staying. About two-fifths of our respondents revealed that they stayed in hotels and motels. About 20% stay in campers and RVs. About 10% stay with friends. We wanted to break out again that the number you mentioned, I think the 2.5 nights, but also how much money are they spending? So they spend on average about $480, and that's based on their most recent trip. So we needed to break that out. And so when you're spending that money, you know, what sector of the economy are you spending your money in? So the biggest portion is lodging, and then followed by restaurants, and then entertainment and groceries as you pick up, you know, food for the family while you're staying here. And so that's really what we wanted to try and do, sort of disaggregate those effects and trying to get an understanding of just more of a understanding of the recreator themselves, you know, where they're staying, what they're spending the money on, what they're doing while they're here, that type of information.
And I believe I'm right when I say that you found that the economic impact of this is about $4.9 billion, and it creates the equivalent of 48,000 full-time jobs. How do you think those figures may have changed as a result of Helene and as a result of inflation?
Yeah, so we're trying. That's exactly what we're trying to do with this new study. I should have mentioned, really, the new study's been funded through the United States Forest Service, and so that's exactly what we want to get at is you know, the effects of Helene and how that's influenced the different sectors of the economy. Can't really speak to it too much, unfortunately, because we just haven't got to that point yet. But again, what you're going to see there's the initial dip, and so as people stop coming here, or stopped coming here just because, you know, infrastructure was down, right? The camping sites were down, the biking trails were down, the hiking trails were down, and so you're going to lose that initial injection of the flow of funds into the economy. And so that 48,000 jobs, that's an annual count based on the level of recreation that would have happened absent Helene. That's going to just take that's going to take that hit, but it'll be a, you know, a short-term hit, right? If businesses are shut and people aren't coming and staying in hotels and spending their money in restaurants, you know, similar really to the effect that COVID had, right? People just stopped moving around, well, going to the local business because they were shut down, you know, same thing here really. So that's really what we want to get a handle of, you know, what will be that initial injection. Now we're sort of seeing that we're coming back. And so, you know, you're gonna have a dip. It's gonna be like a U shape, right? And so you're gonna get the dip in economic activity, but hopefully it's returning back to the baseline, back to the trend that it would have been on anyway had Helene not occurred.
Dr. Ash Morgan is an economist. He's a director of the Center for Economic Research and Policy Analysis at Appalachian State University. But of course, summer outdoor recreation is more than numbers, it's more than the economy. And we're going to get into that in just a moment, particularly with regard to camping and getting young people out, because a lot of young people spend their entire lives on their phones, or it seems that way at least. We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about outdoor recreation and what it does for our economy and what it does for you as a participant. Dr. Ash Morgan is here. He's a professor of economics at Appalachian State University. Dr. Keith Cradle is also with us. He is the founder of Camping with Cradle, which we're going to talk about. That's getting young people out and into the wilderness and into outdoor experience. And Greg Batts is also with us. He's a biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, because when you're out there, you want to keep the animals safe and you want to be safe from them. And we'll talk about all of that as well. Keith, according to the same report that we've been referring to in the first segment from the Outdoor Foundation, participation among households with and without children is up. But we have this idea that kids today spend all their time indoors with their Game Boys or on their phones looking at screens. You work with underserved children. In your case, getting them outside, camping, is camping something that they want to do? Is it something that they gradually warm to after the experience begins? Do you have to twist their arms to get them involved?
If this was a quiz, I'd say all of the above. And so when we think about, you know, our youth and what they do throughout the summers, a lot of that is predicated upon what their parents are into, age range, social dynamics. And so trying to, you know, put inside of that, you know, that weekend or that day, some outdoor activity is paramount for parents. And so what we're trying to do, you know, through Camping with Cradle and other organizations across North Carolina is expose our kids to the outdoors. What is that? What does it look like? But also break down some of that anxiety. And so you'll hear that a lot, that for, you know, particularly when it comes to backpacking, camping and hiking overnights, being away from home, whether that's summer camp in a structured environment. And so kids have to somewhat be led to it a little bit, depending on where you live. So if you live in Buncombe County, if you live in Asheville, if you live around the mountains, and that is commonplace for you, you see it all the time. But if you live kind of in the Piedmont area, Charlotte, Mecklenburg, surround, you might be more apt to just thinking about outdoors as greenways, trails, you know, walking paths, not so much of the camping, the overnights, the 1-2 days. And then if you live towards the beach, you know, as they say, from Murphy to Manio here in North Carolina, you get different experiences in North Carolina. So depending on where you grow up, what you've been exposed to, that kind of creates that pathway to how you look at the outdoors and how you think about what it is that you can do with the outdoors.
So when you talk about anxiety, is it the anxiety, because you deal a lot with camping, is it the anxiety of going out into the woods and sleeping overnight and cooking out and doing all the things campers have to do that you may have not had any experience with in real life? Right. Or is it anxiety of being away from home, as you mentioned?
It's all of that. And so 90% of the kids we've taken out are first time campers. So that means they've probably never left, you know, Mecklenburg County, Charlotte, to experience an overnight trip where they're going to be away from home. They're not going to eventually have access to their cell phone because it's going to die. You know, we're not plugging them up all night. And then we think about, you know, just the whole entire experience of it getting super dark. Now, for many of us who've gone camping, backpacking, hiking, you know, it gets dark out there. So many kids, they think dark is in their neighborhood, but that you still have ambient light, you have car noise, you know, you've got street lights. So the darkness that they experience, if you've hiked out, you know, 5 to 6 miles, is very different from sitting in your backyard. And so now you've got kids who think that they're so tough that, you know, they can walk these streets and feel like nothing's going to happen to them. Crickets, squirrels, you know, noises in the background that you can't see because it's so dark, you can't see your hand. Now the toughest kids become some of the most ardent supporters of anxiety and say, oh my God, what is that? And so, right, they just don't know what is expected of them, you know, when they're that far out or they're not going home the next day. And so it becomes part of that survival instinct. So, you know, you're trying to build esteem, but what you're also trying to do is build resilience and let them know that, one, the outdoors isn't going to kill them. It's not going to hurt them. You know, the worst thing that may happen if you go off trail is maybe a little bit of poison ivy. But at the end of the day, you know, the outdoors is for everyone, and they have to learn that, and they have to learn how to respect it, and they have to learn how to navigate it. And that only happens through continuous activity.
You're taking novices, young people who've never been camping out into the woods. How many converts do you think you have as a result of doing it? How many of them will go back on their own because they want to?
I'd say probably maybe 20 to 30%. One of the great things that we do is they can keep all the gear, you know, that we allow them to have. So we buy them the gear when they go out and they get to keep that. So it's in that realm of, you know, while we're teaching you how to fish, we also are providing you with the equipment. So the next time you want to go out, you don't have to go looking for it, because access is one of those things we talk about as well. And so we all know, as enthusiasts of any hobby, it can get expensive. So what does that mean? That means if you like it and enjoy it, you're going to spend money on it. And a lot of times outdoor gear can cost a lot of money. And for outdoor gear that you want to last a long time, it can really get costly. So we provide that gear for them. We want to make sure that, we provide the experience, but also give them the education to allow them to go back out. I've had a lot of kids. It's usually the kids who say they're going to hate it as we're riding up. They're getting there. Oh, this is going to suck. I'm going to hate this. Are we there yet? And the type two fun as you're hiking up, you hear the complaining, the grumbling. They probably drink all their water and they've eaten all their snacks halfway up the hike. But as soon as they get to the top, and you see that mountainous and you see the mountains in the distance, you see what you've hiked up to. Now they begin to love it, and they start thinking about, wow, I did that. Is there more of this? And it's like, yes, you can just you, there's so many great parks in North Carolina. You just have to get beyond Charlotte. You have to get beyond sometimes just Crowder's Mountain, which is a great introductory space for people, I think, in Charlotte because it's so close. But I believe some of our best parks are usually 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours away from Charlotte in North Carolina. So it's really about access and exposure.
So, Ash, you just mentioned that equipment, camping equipment, fishing equipment, even backpacks for hiking and all the stuff you need, shoes, etc., can be expensive. And getting there is becoming more expensive because of the price of gasoline. I'm just curious about whether this is still, no matter what it costs, still one of the most inexpensive kinds of getaways or vacations that you can take. Is it?
Yeah, I think when you compare it to other, other options that are out there, then yes, I think you don't have to travel too far to go and find some of these opportunities, and you can take a nice day trip hiking, something like that, with relatively little expense. And so yeah, when you compare it to some perhaps some other sort of vacation opportunities where you have to maybe travel farther and stay longer, and I'm sure it's relatively inexpensive compared to those, yeah.
It may be too early to tell, but the mountains have just come out of that Hurricane Helene, the devastation of that, which cut off all of their tourist dollars for a considerable amount of time. And now we're facing inflation where the cost of everything is rising precipitously. Do you have any idea of what the impact of that is on the tourist industry in Western North Carolina?
Yeah, I don't at this moment. Obviously, I think one of the biggest effects you'll see is rising gas prices over the last few months, and so the family who's thinking about taking that trip is going to factor that in. So perhaps they, perhaps we might see that they'll be foregoing some of those trips and staying more locally just because the price of taking the trip itself, plus the hotel stay or the VRBO stay, and the restaurant expense when they get there is. All those things are going up, right? Price levels generally are rising. So I wouldn't be surprised to see, once we get some of the data in, looking back, that people are foregoing some trips and just staying at home or staying more locally and doing other things. And so yeah, you'd expect to see something specifically due to the effect of inflation.
Keith, we're going to talk about what you do for these young people, underserved young people. I know you just said that you provide for them the basic equipment for hiking and camping, and they get to keep it so they can continue that experience on their own if they want to. But what are, for people who are listening who will not take part in camping with a cradle, what are the basic necessities if you want to have a successful camping experience? What must you have?
I'd say just, an openness to learn. I think that it starts there. There's a mindset about getting outside, wanting to exercise, wanting to feel what nature provides. But if we're talking about from a cost standpoint, then it typically it, as Ash was saying, it relatively low compared to other things. So a great pair of hiking shoes, some shorts and a t-shirt, which I think almost everybody owns. And depending on how long you plan on being out there, if it's, if it's 1 hour, 2 hours, backpack, water, snacks, things like that. But if you're thinking about going further then and you're doing miles and you want to spend an overnight, then now you need a backpack, you need a camp, you need a tent, sleeping pad, sleeping bag, depending on, weather and season. And so, those things change with the seasons, depending if you're going out during the summer, if you're going out in the fall. But you know, again, not that expensive, but at the end of the day, you know, you want to make sure you have the correct gear to do this consistently. Because if you're hiking in bad shoes, eventually your feet are going to feel that. And as they say, you can only go as far as your feet will take you.
But surely there are also some rules you need to know. If you've never done this before, do you necessarily just want to pack up the car and go and find a campsite in the woods someplace and camp out? Aren't there things you need to know?
Sure. And so it can start relatively easy, particularly with our state parks. They already got great tent pads, you know, great sites that you can just drive up, pull in, reserve online. Quick, you know, it fire, of course, fire safety. You know, if you're, and I think most people know how to barbecue. It's really, you know, a barbecue outside, and you're just making sure that that fire, you know, doesn't spread. No trace, and I think Greg will talk about that a little bit as well. But you know, making sure you clean up, pack it, you know, pack the things that you brought with you. You want to make sure you know you keep that site clean. So anything that you brought with you take back out. Genuine plant safety. I think you know, make sure you look out for poison ivy, even things that you have around your own home. You know, poison ivy lives in my front yard, so knowing recognize that. And so I think there are some things that you can do that are relatively easy to make your experience, you know, nice and enjoyable. I think people put too much into it sometimes and make it so high level that, oh my God, what do I need to do? A lot of it is typically things you would do at home. You're just not going home
Yeah.
and you're just doing them outside, outdoors, and you have the right gear. If you look around your home, you look around, you know, your garage, you probably have everything you need to go camping. You just have to kind of practice with it, make sure you've done it before, look for inclement weather, and make sure that you're not outside, you know, like anything. If it's too hot, you know, kind of tuck it in, make sure you're not, you know, overheated, you're not extending yourself. And if you have young children, making sure they're in, you know, eye, you know, you can see them, they're in plain view, they're not interacting with things that they shouldn't interact with. A lot of parks here, you're not going to see bears. I don't think you're too worried about that per se, but now bears are moving into Gastonia, so you never know. So it's just really about recognizing where you are, and what you're doing. And like, again, a lot of our state parks have rangers, they have guides, and they can help you out through that process when you're there.
The Greg that Keith just referred to is Greg Batts. He's a biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Greg, when you go into the woods, whether you're hiking or staying overnight camping or staying for several days in a national or a state park, or you are entering a space that is owned and operated by wildlife. They own it. We're intruding on them. What should you know about that wildlife?
Yeah, so you know, Dr. Cradle, you know, mentioned bears. Pretty much, if you go anywhere in the western part of the state, or even the eastern part of the state, you're likely to run into a bear. And we had developed a program called BearWise that the public can go to our website, bearwise.org, to find out the outdoor basics for, you know, going into areas that have bears. You know, a lot of people don't know that. Black bears in North Carolina. We have 20,000 black bears in North Carolina. We have 12,000 on the coast and 8,000 up in the mountains. And we have one of the densest bear populations on the planet. Typical density for bears in, you know, in another state might be 0.8 or 0.4 bears per square mile. In some places in eastern North Carolina, we're at 3 bears per square mile. And not only that, we have some very large bears. In North Carolina, we commonly have bears that are 500 to 700 pounds in coastal North Carolina, and the mountain bears, you know, in the 300-pound range. But getting back to your question, you know, if you go to BearWise and you look at those outdoor basics, you know, being in bear country, a lot of those things go hand in hand for any kind of animal. So, you know, staying alert and staying together, walk with others when possible. You know, keep your kids close at hand, within sight. You know, a big one here is a lot of times you see kids now, what do they got? They've got headphones on their ears, they got earbuds in. Take those things out because you don't know if something, you know, if a bear comes along or a deer's blowing at you or any of those sort of things, a fox is barking at you. You can't hear those things if you got earbuds in your ears. And, you know, just make noise as you move along. Most things, if you give them, tell them basically that you're there, they're going to go away from there. They do not want to interact with people. And so, you know, just make that noise as you're walking along.
Do you find that do you, you may not be able to answer this question, but do you find that most people have a healthy respect for wildlife and keep their distance, or do they get sometimes too close?
Well, it kind of goes both ways, right? If you've ever been to the Smokies, people seem to get brazen in national parks for whatever reason. You can find all kinds of stories on the internet, in the Yellowstones, in the Smokies, of people walking up to bison, people walking up to bears. People seem to view animals that live in national parks like they're visiting a public zoo. People that are visiting the national forest and they're hiking and they're on the AT, that sort of stuff, they tend to be respectful. But people that don't commonly go into the outdoors and go to national parks, a lot of times they get too close, and then the animal sort of makes a move at them, and everybody's got a cell phone camera and all that sort of stuff, and it's bad news for the bear. And it's usually all people caused, and that goes right on down to dogs. I mean, if you got dogs, keep your dog's leash. Don't let your dog off running around when you're in the outdoors. Keep it leashed because they're going to find whatever's out there, and that's going to cause a problem. And then continuing on with some of these other things, don't leave any trash or food scraps. If you're going out there and you're going to go camping. Hey, I've been out there. I've been camping. I know what you're going to have eggs and bacon in the morning. Don't eat bacon and wipe it on your pant leg, and then go and crawl into your tent. A lot of these animals have super sensitive senses of smell. Bears, they know bears can smell stuff from miles away. And when they smell that, that's ringing a dinner bell to come to them. So if you're going to have that kind of stuff, make sure that you put all your food up, dispose of your scraps, bury it, whatever, and don't leave those food scraps around. And then, if you encounter a bear, you see a bear, you see any kind of wildlife, honestly, don't surprise it. You don't want to surprise anything. Let that animal know that you are there. In a case with a wild bear, if you clap your hands at a wild bear, that bear is probably going to turn around and run away from you.
Let me stop you there, Keith, because we have to take a break. We can come back and talk some more about that and other things in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Keith Cradle, founder of Camping with Cradle, where he takes underserved young people into the wilderness for their first camping experiences. Ash Morgan is here, professor of economics and director of the Center for Economic Research and Policy Analysis at Appalachian State University, where they have conducted surveys on the economic impact of the outdoor industry in the state, particularly in western North Carolina. And Greg Batts is a district biologist with North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. We were talking a lot about bears, Greg, just before this, and we know that the movie Jaws essentially criminalized sharks everywhere and kept people out of the water for a good long time and made them very afraid of sharks and made sharks public enemy number one. I don't think we want to do the same thing with bears. Is there anything equivalent to the shark with regard to bears?
No, I don't think so. Bears, black bears particularly, are shy animals by nature. I've trapped a lot of bears, in my job as a wildlife biologist. And if you got up close to a bear and you look it in the eye, they won't look you in the eye. They will cut their eyes away from you. You can intimidate bears. Like I said, they're shy by nature. Most of the time, you're only going to see these bears in the early mornings or the late evenings, and they're most active during those periods. And then at night, that's when they're active. So you're just not going to see them. But if you were to see one, one thing that, I always tell people, and a lot of people that are inexperienced in the outdoors, don't turn and run away. That can trigger response, predatory response for them to run you down. You want to just back away slowly, and you want to talk really loudly to the bear and say, hey, I don't want any trouble. Raise your hands up, make yourself look bigger, and intimidate that bear, and just back away slowly is what you want to do. when you
So
see a
Keith,
bear
when you have
kind of spot.
when you have a bunch of young people who have never been into the woods because they're urban, they grew up in an urban area, with a city, maybe a greenway being the closest thing they have to the wilderness. Are these the concerns? The bears, snakes, foxes, mountain lions, whatever the case may be. Are they overly concerned about those things?
Oh, that's all they're going to ask about is bears, snakes. It's those. I think those are the two big ones. But again, a lot of times they're going to run into hornets, bees. Those things are out there and en masse, and we overlook the bees and the hornets. And you're probably more likely to get stung, by a bee or a hornet than you will, encountering a snake or a bear or a fox. And so we try to make sure they understand that too, because kids love taking a stick. If they see a hornet's nest, they love trying to poke a stick at a hornet's nest for some odd reason. I don't know. But I think that is, to me, those are the bigger concerns, wasps, hornets, bees.
Okay. Greg, you want to say something about that?
Yeah. So I just wanted to add what Dr. Cradle said there, that, probably the biggest thing that you got to worry about, a few things, but mosquitoes are another big thing that you got to worry about, another huge one will be ticks in the outdoors. You do not want to get Lyme disease. I mean, I know some people that have Lyme disease, and it's something that you keep for your life. And so those animals are probably going to be doing more damage to people in the outdoors than an animal like a bear. That's your problem things. Also snakes. There's quite a lot of snakes in North Carolina, a lot of copperheads. You get up into the mountains and into the coast too, there's rattlesnakes out there. And so those venomous snakes, they can hurt you. You're probably not going to die from a copperhead bite. I think one person dies every 4 years from a copperhead bite, but it's extremely painful and extremely expensive. And I always tell people that, most of the time a father will tell a son some sort of, anecdote thing like, son, if you can dream it, then you can make it happen, right? Some sort of sage advice like that. My father's advice to me always going out the door was watch for snakes. That's what he always told me, watch for snakes, and that's good advice, right? Look at your feet. Just don't walk blindly around. If you're walking a trail, and I've seen this a lot of times with like bears will walk trails, and you will find that there will be yellow jacket nests that are into the side of the trail. And a bear will dig that up because they like honey, right? And they like to eat these. They like to eat these yellow jackets because they're high in protein. And so they will dig up any kind of bee nest that they can find. And you can just be walking down the trail like minding your own business, and all of a sudden you're in a swarm of bees that a bear dug up on the trail. And so, but those are some things that are probably more likely that you're going to run into in the outdoors more so than an animal like a bear.
Ash, well, we are ruining, these are the things you don't read about in the tourist brochures. So we are ruining the industry here collectively and individually. We're concentrating a lot on the possible dangers, but for the most part, it's safe. Am I right? Because we're talking about kayaking, canoeing, swimming, hiking, maybe some camping. That's what people indulge in, Ash, in the tourist industry in Western North Carolina, if they want to be outdoors. For the most part, it's safe, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you look at the millions and millions of trips that are taken every year, people aren't taking those trips if it's unsafe for themselves or the family. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it's a case of experiences, and some of the things that have been mentioned here, that's just part of life's experience. You go whack a bee's nest or a hornet's nest, and you see what happens, and it's part of the deal. But I'm sure everything's very safe, and again, you wouldn't see the magnitude of the number of trips if it wasn't.
I mentioned at the start that we have 41 state parks in North Carolina, 10 national parks, and 4 national forests. That sounds like a wealth of outdoor possibilities, Ash. How do we compare to other states in our region and or nationally, and how important are these state and national parks to the economy?
Yeah, very important, right? Those are your natural resources, right? Those are the things you're sort of naturally endowed with. And in comparison to the other states, North Carolina does very well. It's really high up there in terms of the level of visitation. Because I think you've got the breadth also. You've got everything from the beaches to the mountains. And so you've got the breadth of those natural resources that a lot of states can't provide. And so again, the impact that that accrues to North Carolina from all these state parks is very important. And certainly does very well compared to a lot of the other states and across the nation.
It also seems that there's a certain return on investment when you invest in natural spaces and the preservation of natural spaces, as you would in a national or a state park. It's not only important for people's health and well-being, it also shows the importance of environmental stewardship, keeping those places pristine the way nature intended them to be. There is a demonstrable return on investment, and yet the current administration has taken actions that some say weaken protections for our national parks and forests, though they've been framed as cutting red tape and improving access to those places. Critics say that some moves actually open the door to environmental harm by rolling back land use restrictions and safeguards and increasing wildlife disturbance and more. As an economist, what's your take on that?
That's a good question. I think anything that has an impact on with respect to sort of environmental degradation is obviously not going to be good from the recreator perspective and therefore the sort of the economic impact perspective. So hopefully funds are continue to be available to just to maintain the environmental service levels of these parks, so that because that's what's attracting people, and it's not just the flow of money. I've talked today, the only really numbers I've given you today are these economic impact money figures that and they trace the flow of funds, but it's from the economist's perspective. We also think about, I don't bring it up because it's kind of boring, but it's called consumer surplus, but it's a measure of satisfaction, right? I mean, that's what these recreators are getting out of this. That's why you take the trip, because it provides this level of satisfaction, the things that Greg and Keith have been talking about today. And you can measure that too. So that's very important. So yeah, of course, these are just natural resources. You've got to be careful to protect them. You certainly don't want to be going down the road of environmental degradation. There's other challenges too with climate change related events. So got to be careful to try and protect these resources.
And I'm curious, from the point of view of a biologist, the importance that you see these natural these state parks and national parks playing, and the role of preservation of those outdoor spaces, and as make leaving them as undisturbed as possible, and not places to mine for precious metals or drill for oil. What is your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with that. For me, there's a big difference in the words preservation and conservation. For me, I'm a wildlife conservationist. I'm not a preservationist. And so what you see in state parks in North Carolina, they have a very good program where they try to restore and maintain the habitat to optimal levels. What you see in the national park system is generally a preservation system where they keep the status quo. And, through time, there's been lots of challenges for the National Park Service to be able to manage those resources. I'll give you an example. In the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, there is a pine tree called the Table Mountain Pine, which has a serotonous cone, which is a cone that depends on fire to release its seeds. But because of the Park Service policy, they cannot go in there and burn those stands, which they need to do to regenerate those. So, I just want to make that distinction, but yeah, it's very important that that we don't go down, we don't cut all the trees down and drill for oil or drill for that sort of stuff. I think if you want to get the public's ire up, just go and start doing those type of things
Yeah.
because the public does need that. They do need that nature reset.
Keith, you were on the Kelly Clarkson show. I'm not sure how long ago, but you were on and you were talking about your organization, Camping with Cradle, and you mentioned to her that you once worked with the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Department rehabilitating young people who got themselves into trouble. Is this organization, Camping with Cradle, an outgrowth of that? Is this how it started?
Yeah, part of it did. You guys do your homework, I'll tell you that much. So yeah, when I was with the sheriff's office, the kids there didn't have any outdoor recreation, and we actually had a space inside the facility. And so at the time I was working under Sheriff McFadden, and I asked him, I said, hey, what are some things we can do differently? He said, come up with it. And given I was an avid outdoor, person doing backpacking and hiking, I said, let's try to at least utilize that outdoor space. And so while the kids couldn't leave the facility, they could use the outdoor space. So we talked to them a little bit about Camping 101, a little bit about the outdoors, show them how to, set up tents and things like that. And so that was the onus of camping with Cradle, beginning at the sheriff's office. And then, we just kind of grew it from there when I left.
They say that if you go hiking or if you go camping and you stray off the trails, you should certainly have a map with you, and you ought to maybe have a GPS device, maybe your phone. But a lot of these areas don't have great phone signals. So, what are the basic rules if you're going to go out into the woods, either whether it's a national park or someplace else? You need to tell somebody where you're going, correct, and when you are expected back. But what happens if you get lost?
So, right, you should have, the parks provide paper maps. You should have a GPS location system, whether it's a Garmin, or a similar device. But if you end up not getting back, a lot of times they can track that at the front office, that you tell people you're going out. You can have that time, that time stamp. And typically, if you're not back in a certain time, if you can call in, then the park rangers, people that are staffed there will help you find your way back. So there are different protocols for different parks, but at the end, through it all, you should have a policy and a protocol for making sure that someone knows exactly where you are and what time you went back out.
Greg.
Yeah, so that holds true for other things too. If you're going on float trips down rivers, kayak and stuff, people often will have a float trip plan to let them know what's going on. People say GPSs, and people have GPS on their phone and that sort of stuff, but hey, a little compass doesn't cost a whole lot. They make them that go on a watch. And if you have any kind of basic map reading skills and you have a park map, all I got to do is I go, if I keep going east, I'll run into something. And so, in the simplest term, just having a compass on your person will help you in those kind of cases like that.
Of course, you have to know how to read it, and many people have never held the compass in their hands. Keith, much of the state is in severe drought conditions, and if you're going to camp out overnight, you're going to have to have food, and you're probably going to want to cook that food. And I know that you're supposed to cook it as far away from the campsite as possible, so you don't attract wildlife because they smell the food to your tent. But what about the fire? How do you prevent wildfires? Because humans cause most of the wildfires in North Carolina.
Correct. And so while we've had a burn ban for a while, I think it's been lifted just recently. And again, I think you treat it the same way you would be at home. Again, a lot of times the parks, they have those grills. And so if you know how to grill at home, charcoal, firewood, you don't leave that grill unattended either when you're at home. You don't leave it unattended at camp. You make sure it's out. You make sure those embers and coals have been covered up before you depart. And so you have to, again, be vigilant about that. And you have to have some wherewithal about that. And you just can't think, okay, I put it out, whether that's, it's been out all night. A lot of times those embers will be smoking throughout the night. And so you have to make sure that you have taken care of that before you've left. But also think about, again, if you were home, would you leave your grill just fly, just flaming, in the backyard? No, you'd watch it diligently to make sure it wasn't spreading a fire at all.
Now, and you're talking about cooking in a container, in a contained device, whether it's a grill or something else, but you're not talking about campfires. Are people still building campfires, and should
Yeah.
they be in this dry environment?
So you can build a campfire. Like I said, if the state issues a burn ban, then of course that's not going to happen. And we've been under that direction for a while. So you're not worried about that so much. But yeah.
Talking about outdoor recreation, there are a plethora of opportunities here. We talked about the bad and the ugly, but there's a lot of good too. We talked about some of that, and of course, the economic impact is positive for areas of the state that are known for outdoor recreation. Ash Morgan, economist and director of the Center for Economic Research and Policy Analysis at App State. Keith Cradle, founder of Camping with Cradle, and Greg Batts, a biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.